This podcast is brought to you by BetRivers. Download the BetRivers app from the App Store or Google Play Store. Must be 21. Available in Ohio only. Void where prohibited. Terms and conditions apply. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Sports gaming is provided in partnership with Dayton Real Estate Ventures, LLC, DBA, Hollywood Gaming at Dayton Raceway.
If you're a tennis fan, you'll love Betting Weekly Game Bet Match on the Bet Rivers Network. Whether you're a bettor or just love tennis, you'll enjoy the in-depth analysis each week of the tennis calendar. Subscribe to Game Bet Match today from your favorite podcast provider. It's the Mike Francesa Podcast on the Bet Rivers Network.
Hello again, everybody, and welcome to the Mike Francesa Podcast on the Bet Rivers Network, brought to you by Casamigos Tequila. Casamigos Tequila, brought to you by those who drink it. Weather continues to just rain and rain and rain here in New York and the suburbs. And what a awful first week of April. And that's why I always yell at Major League Baseball, considering the Northeast and the Midwest, it is just ridiculous to open the season in late March because you get this foul late March, early April weather. We don't get good weather here in New York till almost May now. You might get lucky and get it the last week in April. It's just never nice. It's just never warm. We don't have spring. We go right from our mild winters, which is what we usually have, and we go right into summer. It's just one day it's 70 degrees and then away we go. I mean, that's just what happens here. We don't have spring anymore. We really don't. And I bring this up because of what happened yesterday. But let me go to the big picture first, okay? The Mets, who have opened 0-4, and that's been a big source of irritation and irritability here for all Met fans and for a lot of the city, they need to immediately fortify their credibility as a franchise. You see, the Mets now have an owner who has given them hope, there's no question. But with that, he is asking them, with new leadership, to be patient. He is asking them basically to also believe in a little bit of blind faith because he's showing them a very, very weak roster and telling them, well, I think we can get to the playoffs. Well, I'm not going to talk record, but I think we can get to the playoffs. This team will need everything to fall into perfect place to have any chance to be a 500 team, no less be above that. And you would figure 9 times out of 10, it is going to take 85 plus wins to get the last playoff spot, minimum. Probably 87, but maybe 85. But to me, the more important thing right now is the Mets need to show that they are not the old Mets, that they have credibility, even though you're asking them to be patient. Now, I don't have a problem with Stern's plan. He wants to take a year to analyze, to observe, to make the right judgment about the young players, to get a look at everybody and then decide who he wants to get rid of, who he wants to keep, and how he wants to build. Plus, they didn't want to throw big money at guys who didn't deserve big money. They went after the couple of big guys. They didn't get them. Next year, there'll be other big guys. There'll be big pitchers. There'll be Soto. And don't think they won't be in on Soto next year. And Soto's going to play this year out, and he's going to go free agent because that's the way it's done by the people who represent them. So, but you're asking Met fans to be patient. And then you're sprinkling in a little, hey, have some faith that we can do it this year, even though we don't show you that kind of roster or that kind of rotation or that kind of lineup. We can overachieve. But if you're going to do that, you have to look smart. And in a couple of instances already, the Mets have looked ridiculous. Not only have they gotten off to a poor start, not hit, in some spots not pitched, already had another injury to the pitching staff, got a great pitch game the other night but couldn't score in 9 innings. Their numbers offensively are at the bottom of baseball already after a couple of games. And they go and sign a legitimate big-time hitter who they want to bring in, hope he can lead the way, he can make be a factor in the clubhouse, he can teach a little bit, and he can also put something close to the numbers he put up last year and what he's put up for his career. Now, J.D. Martinez, who they've paid $12 million, decides he needs additional spring training. I mean, give me a break. This is a guy who's had 1,500 games, almost 6,000 at-bats, over which he's hit .287, hit over 300 homers, hit over, knocked in over 1,000 runs. He could have been here from day one, and it would have legitimized things to the fans. He might not have hit in the cleanup spot the first couple of games. He might have needed a couple of games to knock the rust off, but he could have knocked the rust off in the major leagues. When he's been the kind of hitter he's been, and he's been in the major leagues for 15 years, he knows how to do that. He doesn't need to be down there. And it's a bad sign that he's there, and he's still there. Now, they can bring him back by Sunday, and they probably will. But he never should have been there in the beginning because it makes them look ridiculous. And the one thing they don't need right now, on top of everything else, is to look stupid and just look like they don't have a clue. And that goes on the field and off the field. And yes, yesterday is an example of off the field. That game should have been called by noon. The weather forecast was dire. It was going to get worse all day. It rained all day. My wife and I had to go to a funeral yesterday morning. It was pouring. The weather forecast, no matter what you looked at, had rain continuing to get worse today, intensifying today, and not stop until tomorrow sometime. There was no window to play that game. What were they doing? The Yankees, just to use an example, would have called that game at 10 o'clock in the morning. The Mets brought everybody out there last night and didn't call a game until almost 9:15. I mean, what are they doing? They don't need, on top of everything else, a very unlucky start. Injuries to the pitching staff. No Senga. Now another injury to the pitching staff, to the starting rotation. Martinez down in the minor leagues. Guys batting cleanup who shouldn't be anywhere near the place. And then to have four guys in the lineup who were considered to be veteran players open up 3-for-51. They don't need to add to this. They need to be on point. They need to show that they have some smarts, that they are at least, if they aren't good and aren't presenting you and spending their money and presenting you with a big roster this year, and asking you to be patient, and asking you to have some blind baseball faith, they need to look the part. And when they do things like the Martinez thing, and like the rainout yesterday, they look like they are as bad as they've ever been, and don't have a clue how to run things either on the field or off the field. They have to be better than this. They have no margin for error when it comes to baseball credibility. And let's be honest. From a business standpoint, the worst thing that could have happened to them was to get off to a bad start and have the Bombers with two of the three best players in the major leagues in the same lineup get off to a fast start. Because whether you believe it or not, there is a middle ground in this town where people are going to go to anywhere from 4 to 6 to 8 baseball games a year. And they're going to go where it is exciting, where there is an attraction and there is a reason to go. And those people can go to Citi Field if the team is doing well, and they can go and buy Yankee tickets. And right now, those people who can go either way. We're not talking about the diehards here. We're not talking about the season ticket holders here. We're not talking about the diehards. We're talking about the middle ground. And there is a middle ground that sways back and forth based on what happens. There's a lot of front runners in New York. There's a lot of front-running fans and a lot of people who just go to events. New York is an event town. When a team's hot, it draws. When a team has something to sell, it draws. If you offer them nothing, you will get nothing in return. The Mets have now, and they couldn't do this. They could not get off to this kind of start. Now, I don't know if they're going to play today. Tonight, it looks really bad. They might have to play a doubleheader tomorrow. I know they've already scheduled a game tomorrow. At 1 o'clock, they could schedule 2 at 12 if they have to squeeze two games in the schedule tomorrow, if they don't play tonight. They can do that. That's fine. They can't leave town 0-6. If they do, we're looking at a nightmare. Four games on the road with the Braves coming up. Three games on the road with the Dodgers coming up. Three games on the road with the Giants coming up. They don't do well there when they have a good team. They could get destroyed in those three places. And by the time you get to the middle of April, like the 23rd of April, when they leave Giants, when they leave San Francisco, they could be so buried that they never see the sunlight again this season. Now, that's a dire prediction. Absolutely. But you know what? Be realistic. They needed to get off in these first nine games at a decent clip. 5-4 would have been nice. 6-3 would have been wonderful. 0-6 before they hit the road is not what they were looking for. They're 0-4 right now. I don't know if they're playing one more game in the series, two more games in the series. We don't know that yet. But we do know this. They have to be smarter. They have to show better leadership. Get Martinez out of the minor leagues the day you can and smarten up when it comes to dealing with your fan base and dealing with just the general public. They looked like fools doing that last night. Not one person thought there was a chance they could play except them. And then they have everybody hanging around for hours and then have to call the game at 9:15, which should have been called at noon. Smarten up. I mean, just ridiculous. You know, as we head toward, and the Yankees lost last night, folks. Listen, for those of you who thought they were going to win them all, sorry. They got shut out last night. They got three hit. It's going to happen. Now, Volpe got a hit last night again. He's off to a very good start. There's going to be a lot of clamoring for him to go to the leadoff spot. Be patient. Let him get off to this fast start. Let him put some games under his belt. And if he continues to show patience at the plate, we know he's going to put up some numbers that were going to be better than last year's. He's got power. He's got speed. He's going to be a very productive player. Whether he's a leadoff player or not, he has to show you that over a little more time. Let's see how he handles pitch selection. So far, he looks much improved in that area. But it's only been a small sampling. He's hot with the bat right now. He looks good right now, so everything's going well. Let a couple weeks go by, and then there's plenty of time to slide him into the leadoff spot. And yes, he would be a very good candidate to be a leadoff hitter. Now, I talked to you a few times about the draft and said how interesting this draft is going to be, and it's going to be fascinating because the teams that are looking to trade up, that are there looking to trade up, Denver doesn't have the resources to trade up too high, so I don't think they can get up high enough to get one of the early quarterbacks. Minnesota can, and they've set themselves up to do that. After, of course, Williams is off the board at one, and they've taken their quarterback at two, Washington. They're taking a quarterback. They're not trading out of that spot. They're taking a quarterback. And if you ask me right now, I think they're taking Daniels, but I wouldn't take it to the bank, but I think every indication is they're taking Daniels. Which leaves May and McCarthy. And I think Knicks is going to wind up going a lot higher than people think. I think he will go before 15. I don't think Penix Jr. will. I think he'll go probably either very late one or early two. I think that Knicks will go off the board before 15 and may go off the board higher than that. The first five picks in this draft are going to be four quarterbacks and Harrison. One, two are going to be quarterbacks. Harrison could go three, four, or five. Based on trades, based on who gets what and everything else, three, four, five. So by the time you get through five, you're going to have the four quarterbacks and Harrison off the board. Then you're going to get a run on the wide receivers. I think the Giants will take one. And I think that's where you'll get Neighbors and Odunze off the board. And then you're going to get to the Jets at 10. And I know a lot of people are talking about them taking Bowers at 10 at the tight with the tight ends and taking him at the tight end. Listen, I like Bowers a lot. I liked Kincaid a lot when he was at Utah. I thought he'd be a good pro. You saw how well he played last year for Buffalo. I think Bowers will come in and be an immediate impact guy. I think he'll catch 50 balls in his first season. So do I think he's a good pick? In a normal year, I think he's a good pick, but I don't think the Jets should pick him. I think the Jets should 100% commit the first round pick to another tackle. They aren't there yet. They've done a nice job. I'm happy with what they did in free agency. I would have done a little more. I would have gotten Smith, and I also would have gotten one of the guys who went before they got involved. So there were players I liked better than the other guys they got, but what they got is useful, and I believe Smith is a home run, an absolute home run. I think people will be raving about him this year. And remember, last year, he played over 950 snaps. I know he's injury prone, but when he plays, he's a Hall of Fame player. And last year, he was the number one pass blocker in the NFL. Number one rated pass blocker in the National Football League. That's who the Jets now will start day one at left tackle. That's why he was that important. How much different is that than the garbage they gave you last year when they're going to give you a guy who was the number one pass blocker in the league at left tackle? Now, he was under the number one tackle. He was the number one player on the offensive line in pass blocking in the NFL last year. But they need to take another tackle. Now, put it in perspective. If Ault's there, and I'd say it's 50-50 that Ault's there, Tennessee could take anybody. A lot of people have them taking Ault. Now, Ault could go five to the Chargers. It's not impossible, but I don't think he will. He's going to be on the board, I believe, after the four quarterbacks and Harrison go off the board the first five. Ault could go to Tennessee. I'd say it's 50-50. If he doesn't, he's probably going to be there for the Jets. If the Jets get the good fortune of Ault being there at 10, if they don't take him, they should be shot. Now, if he's gone, they have a little tougher decision between Bowers, who, like I said, I think is going to be a wonderful player, and the two tackles that would be rated to take there. And that's the Oregon State tackle and the Penn State tackle. And people have gone back and forth which one they like better. I know in a lot of places the Oregon State tackle has moved ahead of them, the Penn State tackle. I like the Penn State tackle better. I think he has a better chance. I know he wasn't as good last year as he was the year before, but he didn't allow any sacks last year. And I think he's the guy. I would still take him. If Ault's there, it's a no-brainer. The Jets should throw pop champagne corks and take Ault. and just be thrilled that they got some good fortune for a change. If Walt's on the board and they don't take him, I would be so disgusted I can't even tell you. I still think they need to take a tackle there at 10 and not take Bowers. They can improve the tight end. Will Bowers be there later? No, he won't. He's going to go off the board right after that. He's a very talented kid. But he's not a must-have for them. They can be fine at tight end without him. They added a wide receiver. You can find terrific talent at wide receiver on the third round, the fourth round, without question, the second round. You don't need to go take anybody. They're not going to take a wide receiver anyway, but they shouldn't even take Bowers that high. I like Bowers. If they had everything else, I would take Bowers. But not for them. They need a tackle. Now, remember, Smith's going to be, I think, good for them next year. They might get 2 years out of him. No more than that, though. He's old. And the guys they brought in are not young. They need to build this offensive line. This is the way to do it. I know they're going for it next year. And they added a wide receiver. And they got Tyrod Taylor as the backup quarterback, which was good. And they've added three offensive linemen in free agency, including a terrific left tackle. I agree with all that. Add another tackle here. This is what you need. Overdo the offensive line because it's that important. Without it, without the strength, having some depth and versatility, you cannot keep this quarterback healthy. And that is the number one objective. He will put the ball on the numbers for everybody. He will make normal receivers look wonderful. Don't worry about that. This guy is gifted, but you have to keep him upright. And that's why it should be on the board in the Jets building. One mission, protect the quarterback. That's it. When they had Namath, Weeb said, hey, we are going to protect this guy. No matter what. Take a page as an organization from a brilliant football coach that once was part of your organization. Weeb Ewbank won the two most important games ever played in the NFL. He won both of them. The Colt game over the Giants and the Jet game over the Colts. And all he said when they had a gimpy-kneed, talented quarterback was, we are going to protect him. And that's what has to happen here, which is why they need to take a tackle at 10. They need to take a tackle at 10. And if Alt's there, pop the champagne corks, because that will be a home run. That will be a guy who will be a 10-year starter, maybe a 14-year starter, a multiple-time All-Pro. He is a can't-miss player on the offensive line. Can't miss. Right pedigree. Write everything. A 6'7" tackle. Like I said, 50-50 is there. Now, I want to get into something for a second. Yeah, a lot of times I get into TV stuff. But there was something the other night that I don't think has gotten anywhere near the attention that it should have received. There's no question that this Iowa basketball star for the women, Caitlin Clark, has gotten an unbelievable amount of attention. I don't care if you've never seen a college game, and I can tell you right now, I don't even know the last time I watched a women's basketball game, to be fair. I am not a big follower of women's athletics. I understand the growth of women's athletics. I'm not getting into a debate here. I'm not trying to be in any way, you know, difficult here or offensive or chauvinistic or anything else. I'm here to laud something that happened and to say it's significant. The Iowa-LSU game, where she put on a show, she had 41 points. It had 12.3 million viewers. The women's basketball game with her had 12.3 million viewers with a high level at the point of the highest audience had 16 million viewers. Now, put that in perspective. This is a women's basketball game. And think about the significance of this going forward as a product. And the thing you have to decide is this just this comet across the sky and this one-time woman? Or has the growth of the game occurred that she has helped foster and will help foster in the future? 12.3 million viewers, 16 at peak. That's more than any Major League Baseball game last year. No World Series game did 12 million viewers. Two of them only did 9 million viewers. So it outdrew every game of the World Series. It outdrew every NBA game on the season, every NBA playoff game on the season. Except game five of the finals was the only one that topped that number. One NBA game topped that number. No baseball games topped that number. Just as an example, last year the Final Four, the men's Final Four, did 12 million viewers. The championship game did 17 million viewers, which wasn't great, but did 17 million viewers. Now, football's a different animal. An example, the Michigan championship game to 25 million viewers. So I'm not talking about football. Football, the only sports that have, NFL numbers are in a different world, and the only sport that is showing enormous growth, other than women's basketball now, has been the college football product with the playoff and with the enormous dominance of the SEC. The college football packages on TV have done very well, and the Big Ten Network as a product has made those schools a fortune. But this game means that they have to decide whether this is just clock or the women's game has grown to the point where it is a significant TV product. When you think that the World Series games last year drew 9, 9, 9, 10, and I think 11.8 or something, the first four, none of them reached 12 million viewers. Only one NBA game reached 12 million viewers on the whole year and the finals. They had 16 million people watching this game at one point. That is outrageous. And it has to have people talking in a lot of places. And they might consider it a one-time deal. Or has the growth of that sport, which means to me what one of two things. Either more men will watch the women's game than we think, or the women as a force, and they control more TV sets than the men do, women as a force are watching this product. Now, I've had golfers, guys I play with, tell me they like to watch the women golfers because they think the game is more like their game than the men's game, which is, you know, they hit it a mile, their club head speed is outrageous, they spin it, they do things with the wedge that's magic, and no one can even, you know, comprehend such stuff. So watching the women, who don't spin the ball like that because they don't get that kind of club head speed, you know, it's more like the typical male player who might be a 10 or a 12 or a 14, you know, like me, I'm a 14. So, you know, that kind of thing. But I was stunned by the numbers for the women's basketball. Absolutely stunned. And this is a significant thing. It at least bears watching. Now, I know she's been offered, you know, she's been offered to play with the, you know, and that's the almost insulting part at times. And I think she should just forget about that. Is often when you have a woman like this, like when Michelle Wee came along and people saying, oh, put her on a men's tour. Well, she was having trouble beating the ladies. Why put her on a men's tour? Yes, she hit it a long way. Yes, she could drive it 300 yards. But you know what? She wasn't winning. And they really damaged her by doing that nonsense stuff with her. But the women's products, as TV products going forth, as, you know, products you can buy and sponsor and everything else, that is a significant jump. That is outrageous. When you think about it, if I had told you that women's basketball outdrew the World Series last year, would you believe it? Or outdrew every NBA final game except one, would you believe that? I wouldn't. It's either a very changing world or she has an incredible amount of appeal, one or the other. Executives have to figure out which one. Now, I told you I liked the NIT that I thought, first of all, I thought the NIT did a very good job this year. I thought they had teams in it that were good. I thought that they had good matchups. I thought that the level of play was very high. Last night, you had four teams that really wanted it. Two of them went on to win. Indiana State, which had a big home field advantage, withstood Utah in a well-played game. And Seton Hall, as I told you yesterday, I thought would happen, just beat up on Georgia, which I thought would happen yesterday. Now you have a terrific NIT final tomorrow night. And ironically, it's the two teams that really belonged in the NCAA tournament. The two teams that had the biggest gripe were Seton Hall, which actually beat UConn this year and played well enough to get in. St. John's would have played a lot better than Virginia did in the NCAA tournament, and I think would have probably even won a game the way they were playing at the end of the season. But you know what? They didn't do a lot during the season. They lost to some bad teams, like Villanova did, and they didn't beat a lot of good teams. They only beat one team that was in the tournament, and that was Creighton. So I thought Seton Hall had a big gripe, and I thought the team that knew it wasn't going if it lost its conference championship game, Indiana State, as a body of work, their NIT was, you know, St. John's was yelling about their NIT. Indiana State's NIT was the highest of any team that didn't get in. Indiana State was a beautiful team to watch, as I told you. And if you watched them last night, you saw that. They are really, they shoot well. They move the ball well. They're a great cutting team. I mean, it's a great final. Now, Indiana State's got a big advantage because the game's being played in Indiana. So it's being played at Hinkle. So you have a big advantage for Indiana State. They had a big crowd there last night. So you don't want to have a big crowd there. So it's going to be very much an Indiana house. So they've made Indiana State the favorite by 3.5 points. I think the wrong team's favorite. I understand that it's a home game, or a home neutral, if you want to call it, for Indiana State. But I think Seton Hall's the better team. I think it's going to be a terrific game. Seton Hall's rugged defense, toughness on the boards, but they do have some scorers, and they are very well coached. Indiana State, with their wonderful offense, with what Avila brings, who is a terrific college player, a very unique college player. You like unique players. He's a unique player if you haven't seen him. He's the guy with the glasses. He's a unique player. Indiana State's been made a 3.5-point favorite. I like Seton Hall. I think, as a matter of fact, I think Seton Hall should be – I thought it was Seton Hall 1 myself, and it's Indiana State 3.5. So they're giving Indiana State – they know it's a home crowd for them, and they're giving them the edge over Seton Hall. And I think Seton Hall comes from a tougher league, and they do the hammer and nail stuff really well. They're gritty. They're tough. They're going to get on the board. They're going to pound. And they'll get enough scoring from Richmond and Dawes especially to, I think, to win. But I think it'll be a very good, I mean, if this game's more than 5 points in the last 3 minutes, I'd be surprised. I think it's going to be a very close game and a very good NIT final and a worthy one. And I like that they both care. I like that they both want it. I like that both coaches want it. The kids want it. You don't want to see this blasé, you know, we don't really care about this thing. They care. They want to win this. Yes, they both wanted to be in the NCAA tournament. They were bitterly disappointed that they weren't in the NCAA tournament. But this is something that they can build off. It's been a very big year for Indiana State, which, of course, lives off that great run they had with one of the incomparable players of all time in Larry Bird. They went undefeated to the final game and lost to Michigan State and Magic Johnson. They went into that game undefeated. I think they were 33-0, if I remember right. They were over 30, but I think it was 33-0. And then they lost that game. Bird didn't play well. He didn't have enough help, and they made sure that he wasn't going to play well, but he didn't shoot the ball well. But they were really had a great run that year to get to the championship game. And Indiana State's done a very good job here. So has Seton Hall. They both belonged in the NCAA tournament, no question. Drake went instead of Indiana State. Drake was a good team, no question about it. It's a good league, but they knew they weren't going to get two teams in. And Seton Hall, coming from a rugged league, having beaten UConn, having the resume they had, they should have been in, but it broke badly with the upsets. And one of the teams that stole the bid was NC State. By winning the ACC, and look where they are. They're in the Final Four. Taking on Purdue. Now, if you notice about those two games on Saturday, the Purdue game against NC State and then the UConn game against Alabama, Purdue opened 9.5. They're down to 8.5. People are buying into NC State. I don't think it's a good matchup for NC State. I'll get into it more on the weekend, on Friday, but I don't think it's a good matchup for NC State. And then UConn opened at 11, is now at best 12.5, and I've even seen 13s. I wouldn't be surprised if it was 14.5 by game time. I don't see why anybody bets Alabama. And I picked Alabama to go to Final Four. I don't think they have a chance in this game. I think the only way they can play is to run and gun and to try and get some mismatches that they like to get. They like to run the ball and create some mismatches in coverage with their quickness and with their ability. A lot of times they've done that with a small lineup. They can't do that. See, the problem with UConn is the size of these guys, other than that, first we got a 7-1 center in there who's going to be nightmare for Alabama. Then you got guys like Castle. Castle could shut down anybody. I mean, he's 6'5", 6'6", and he's jumps to the moon. So if you're a guard and you're playing against him, first of all, on his end of the floor, you cannot play him. Secondly, he'll play you all over the floor. The weak spot you go after is Spencer, but they'll make sure that he doesn't have the prolific scorer. They don't have a weakness, and Alabama needs to run and gun. That's their game. All right, they're a good offensive rebounding team because they rebound in space. They get mismatches. They get matchups that are ugly for the other team, where you got a big on a guy who's going to take you outside. You got a slow guy on a fast guy. They're good at that. And they have guys who can, and Sears can shoot threes from 30 feet in. He's golden. As you saw him in the second half, he hit 7 in a row. With the Final Four on the line, he hit 7 straight threes. I mean, that's as good as it gets. Because in those games, it always comes down to making shots at the end. You got to have somebody who can make a shot. And UConn has so many guys who can make a shot, and they have size, and I mean, they have no weakness at all, and you don't want to run with them. And if you have a drought where, God forbid, Alabama comes out and bricks their first, which I've seen them do in the tournament, they brick their first four or five. I mean, in the game, in their last game, they did not get off fast on Clemson was up 13. They were missing every shot. Sears missed his first seven shots. You do that against UConn, the score's going to be 30-11. That's the difference. It's going to be over. It's going to be over before it starts. As the Illinois coach said, you can't have a drought against them. If you have a drought, they've put up 15 points. They turned the drought not into a little run where a team might, you know, put together a 5 or 6 point run. They put together 22 in a row. In that game, they put together 30 in a row against Illinois. Illinois is a top team. They scored 30 straight points. So, I mean, Alabama, the best thing they can do is hope UConn's cold from the perimeter, which sometimes they are. Hope they're hot from three. And if that's the case, they'll only lose by 6 or 8. That's the best case scenario. And it's a remote one. I think they could beat 80-100. And I really want Purdue in the final. I think it'll happen now. I like their matchup against NC State. I think they match up very well. I was very worried about their matchup with Tennessee. It was not a great matchup. As I told you, I thought it would be a very close game late, and then Purdue would edge out with a couple of free throws. It wasn't a couple. They got a million free throws down the stretch, and they missed a million free throws. The reason that game wasn't 12 instead of 6 was the fact that the big man just kept clanging. I mean, he was 14 to 22. He really missed another one because he got an extra one because somebody went in the lane early. He really was 14 to 23 from the foul line. That's not good enough. He usually makes more free throws. He missed a ton. He missed a couple of one-on-ones. He clanged a lot. And Kinnick couldn't have had a better game for Tennessee, but nobody else was that good. And, you know, the big man got 40 points. Edie got 40 points and 16 rebounds, but he was 14 to 23 from the foul line. So they won by 6. They should have won by more. In this game, the size thing is going to really kill NC State. NC State's going to get in serious foul trouble, and then bink, bink. And when you try and double him, Purdue did not hit their threes against Tennessee. If they come out, and they usually do hit some threes, especially the ones in the corner off the double team, right to the corner, short corner, boom, that three usually is deadly. They hit it at about a 45% clip, and next thing you know, you're already down 10, 12 points. Purdue's going to win that game, and I'm going to get the final I really want to see on Monday night. I really want to see the big man, the player of the year. He's earned all that. Okay, in his regional final game, the game he had to win, he put up 40 and 16. He had the big block on Kinnick when they screwed the game up and they got back where Kinnick came down the field, down the court, down 5, and drove the basket with 20-something seconds left, and Edie blocked his shot. That ended the game. That was the final play. Because if they had scored there or gotten a 3-point play, who knows? Because they were... amazingly, Purdue, which I didn't understand in the last seconds, they're throwing the ball into Edie. What are you doing? I understand he's an easy release because of his size, but you don't want him on a foul line late. You got three guys who shoot over 84%. Why do you want him touching the ball in the last minute? You don't. That could cost you a championship if you do that again. Now, Connecticut's not overly deep. They have 8 really good players. They use the three guys. De'Ara does a great job. The backup center goes in and gets dunk after dunk. Stewart, they do a good job. They're 8 strong. Purdue and Edie will get Klingon in foul trouble. If they get more than him in foul trouble, that's where they can win the game against UConn. They have a chance to win the game. Nobody else does that. Nobody at the Final Four has a chance to beat UConn except Purdue. And Purdue's chance isn't great. UConn's better. Klingon's not as good as Edie, and he's going to get in foul trouble from what I've seen, he's going to get in foul trouble. He's going to go after Edie, and he's going to. But I want to see the two big men play. I want to see him played straight up by another 7-footer. I mean, I'm looking forward to that. That's going to be fun on Monday night to see two big men and how the game. That's going to be fat. I'm going to love that. I can't wait for that. We got plenty of time to talk about that. They first have to both take care of their business, and I think they both got a matchup they can be very comfortable in. Hey, I love what Alabama's done. It made me look good, me picking them for the Final Four, but you know what? It ends here for them. Sorry. This is not a good matchup. Nobody's a good matchup against UConn, but this is not a good matchup for them in a lot of ways. It just isn't. In a minute, we'll finish up with some emails.
You're listening to the Mike Francesa Podcast on the Bet Rivers Network.
Remember, if you want to send some emails, send them to MikeFrancesaPodcast@gmail.com. Again, MikeFrancesaPodcast@gmail.com. We're working on other things that we're going to be doing, okay, in the podcast. We have to make some technological changes. We are working on that right now. I will tell you when we make them what we're going to do, but it will obviously allow you to communicate with me in real time, and we will work on that right now. Now, Seth, I can't watch Stanton looking bad at the plate, striking out. Even if he blasts a homer every now and then, what options do the Yankees have, assuming this continues? Hey, the Yankees bought into this. They got him as a gift because Jeter had to unload him somewhere, and there were very few teams that could afford him. He could have gone to San Francisco. He didn't want to. He has had his moments. I was dead set against him coming here. I didn't want a lumbering, older, right-handed bat that was going to clog up the lineup and clog up the DH. I didn't want him here. Okay? I don't doubt his ability to hit the ball hard. We all know he can. We all know he has his moments. Right now, you're stuck with him. John, if Volpe continues to hit with a high average, should the Yankees move him to the leadoff spot? It's not about the average. It's about the walks. It's about pitch selection. It's about him working counts. He was very poor at that last year. He walked 50 times and struck out 167 times last year. That's not a leadoff hitter, especially when he's batting, you know, in the low 200s. You want a guy at leadoff with a 360 or more on base percentage, and you want him to look at pitches. Let's see how he profiles. He's profiled better in that area. He's had better, he stayed back on the baseball, and he also has done much better in terms of pitch recognition and the idea of where the strike zone is. There's no rush for this. Will it eventually happen? If he continues and he puts a, if he puts a 350 on base percentage up, he's gonna lead off. There's no question. Because of his speed and everything else. And he's a very useful player. There's no question. Phil, as great as Brunson and Knicks look, I think Miami would be a bad matchup. What do you think? You always have to give Miami respect. They are brilliantly coached. They get every ounce out of everybody. Their role players understand their roles. Their stars understand what they have to do. They completely, there's very few teams you will encounter in the postseason who understand what their roles are and execute them more proficiently than Miami does. They don't always win because they don't have the best talent, but they get the best out of their players. It makes them dangerous. I think the Knicks would beat them. Douglas, here's the problem with the Mets and their start. There's no chance the team can play 5 to 6 games over 500 the rest of the year, so the year's over. listen, you just want to be a little more optimistic than that. Do I have any reason for the optimism? No, I don't. If you're telling me I don't think they're going to finish 500, do you think they're going to finish 500? The answer is no. I took them as an under at 80. So obviously 80.5 under. I didn't think they were winning half their games. I did not. First of all, I thought they could move players in the middle of the season, which could diminish them in the short term as they look to rebuild. And let's be honest, they are trying to compete while they are refurbishing this team and could refurbish it significantly if they decide that they're not signing Alonso and they trade him off. And he winds up going to the Cubs like everybody thinks. Their starting pitching is just not good enough on a day-in and day-out basis. I look at it and say, as I've been taught through the years, how do you fill 9 innings over 162 games? And add in a couple extra innings, but you have to fill these innings in. They don't have the arms to fill these innings in when you look at the starting rotation and their bullpen. Now, their bullpen might be okay, and Diaz Beck is an enormous factor. I'm not saying he's not. And listen, I was more wrong about Diaz than any player I can remember in a very long time, because I thought after his first year here, which was horrific, that he would never recover. I thought he should be dealt. And I was dead wrong. He recovered, and he recovered in a big way. He had an historic year, and then he had an unfortunate injury. He has handled his recovery from that first year dramatically well, and I was dead wrong. So he is a big factor for them. As a matter of fact, let's be honest, he's their biggest star. He is their biggest star. The buzz in the stadium, Alonso is a star. Lindor is a star, but they're lukewarm at times on Lindor. But Diaz is the one that, excites the fans. He's the one they get all excited about. When they have a lead and they go to – when you have that kind of closer who's an event closer, and that's what Diaz has become. He's become just like you used to hear Enter Sandman. I mean, you know what was coming. Or the days of Sparky Lyle and Pomp and Circumstance, okay? And he used to come in and throw the jacket, the whole thing, the count, the whole thing. Hey – when you have what I call the event closer, where it is now an event in the stadium when he is coming in the ninth inning to put the finishing touches on a victory, he's your star. The Yanks had that forever. The Mets have it now with Diaz. As far as 500, it is really important that the Mets don't dig this hole any deeper. Because especially looking at those 10 road games they have coming up against teams that they don't match up against. And those games are all coming, and they're coming right around the corner. They're going to see the Braves next week. Your thoughts on the NFL playing on Christmas Day this year, which is a Wednesday. Listen, the NFL has made it completely clear. They take no prisoners now with the TV schedule. They don't care about anybody else. They don't care about any other league. They don't care about anything. They are now going to occupy every holiday. They even went to Black Friday with a game. They now are playing not a game on Christmas. They're playing a doubleheader on Christmas on a Wednesday. They used to avoid Christmas like the plague. Because of the criticism from the Kansas City-Miami game, which went forever, on Christmas, they stayed away forever from Christmas. They now are jumping on anything they can jump on. Now, remember, they can't just overpower. Well, why wouldn't they take every day of the week, which is a good question. Remember, there is legislation that keeps them off Friday and Saturday. Congress legislates against, that's why the NFL always comes to Saturday after the Army-Navy game, because the college season's over. They protect college football. High school football is protected where a lot of places it plays Friday night in the big parts of the country, like Florida, Texas, etc. They play Friday night games, Friday night lights. They protect Friday night for the high schools. They protect Saturday for the colleges. That is done by law. That will not change. The NFL will wait, and the last couple of weeks of the NFL season, they go to their triple headers on Saturday. That will stay the same. They will not infringe early on that. But any other holiday now, boom, 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 they're going. And now they're playing a doubleheader on Christmas this year. So, yes, have they made a aggressive scheduling change? They have. Do they care about anybody else? Heck no. They're the NFL. They could care less. They don't take any prisoners, and they just scorch the earth when it comes to, you know, television. They own television. They are television. We'll see you later.
Thanks for listening to the Mike Francesa podcast on the Bet Rivers Network.